I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Anthony Desai joins me now. He has just published a new book, Children of the Moon. It is a novel of love, war, and memory in all of its complexities. Poe is born in Tanzania. It is 1956, and she is a child with albinism. As such, she faces ostracism as well as violence, as she is seen as a curse on her tribe. We also meet Ezekiel, adopted by missionaries in the Portuguese-controlled Mozambique. He is not recognized by his father's community or by his mother's Makonde tribe. Poe and Ezekiel come together, and their love confronts the impact of war and colonialism. I'll get Mr. Desai to tell us about his moving novel, as well as these characters, the situations they find themselves in, and how memory is tested. Anthony Desai is the author of the novel Kicking the Sky and the collection Barnacle Love that was a finalist for the Scotia Bank Giller Prize. He attended the Humber School for Writers and is a teacher librarian at Michael Power St. Joseph High School in Toronto, where he lives and where he joined me from last week. AnthonyDesai.com is the website for more. This book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Anthony Desai. Mr. Desai, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So the three main characters, if you will, I mean, in the order that we meet them, Poe, Seraphim, and Ezekiel. In terms of telling the story of Children of the Moon, as you have, telling it, for, I guess, is each chapter about each person, I guess?
Well, it's about each point of view of that person and how they see their particular situation, yes.
What's very interesting is throughout the book, I guess, as you tell the story, the points of view sometimes run contrary to one another, don't they?
That's right. There is a sense that they all have their own individuality, their own lives, and that the road that leads them to the place where all three of their lives will converge is separate from the ones they started off on.
And that's an interesting perspective, because we all have different ideas of what happens to us, and that could be very different from someone who experiences the same moment, say.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. What when you write a book like Children of the Moon, and you have to ponder, say, how someone perceives what's happened to them, is some of your own personal experience in that? I mean, if you're talking to someone and they're recounting something that you both experienced, that must strike you in a different way, especially if the other person has viewed that moment or that situation in a different way than you have.
Right. I mean, there's always two sides to the coin, and what's important is to give voice to that individual's perception of the way they see events. It's one of the reasons why the art of public discourse has gone down the tubes, is because we can't accept that someone else sees it very differently from the way we see it. And so most of what these characters in the book are reacting to and the way they see their world was shaped by my travels to Tanzania and Mozambique and South Africa during the research process, in interviewing people and really opening myself to the possibility, and without making any presumptions, about what it was that they went through and how they saw themselves coming out of that difficult situation.
Now, your travels in Africa that you just alluded to, how long into that process of research, say, did you first meet Peter Ash?
Peter Ash was one of the first. So Peter Ash, who is the CEO of Under the Same Sun, mm-hmm. A nonprofit organization that serves to bring awareness to the problem of what is going on in Africa in terms of people with albinism. I think as early as 2014, I read an article in the National Geographic about what was happening in Tanzania in particular to people with albinism. And I was horrified. And so I delved in and read everything I could, and his name kept appearing as this champion of bringing awareness to the current global situation. And so I just called him up in British Columbia, and we chatted for an hour, and within that time period, I had convinced him to take me on his next trip to Tanzania to work with people with albinism and to see just the kinds of things that they do, and to interview and really just to listen for the most part. I went in there with that kind of arrogance of, I have all these questions that I need to ask, and I asked very little. I just listened because they were more than willing to share their stories, their fears, their troubles, and their sense of hope. It was really a privilege.
I've not talked to Peter, despite being from the same. He lives in Burnaby, I guess.
Yeah.
I've never talked to him, but I've had Emily Urquhart on the show before. And Garth Mullins, and they both, in their work, have talked about Peter and his import, I guess, in terms of raising awareness about albinism. So when you're in Africa. And you're talking to, you're listening to these people as they're talking to you. I guess a lot of that infuses the character of Poe.
Exactly right. I mean, so much of Poe is shaped by the experiences of many of these women, and certainly many of the children that I had the privilege of sitting with and listening to, if they were able to speak, if they were able to express themselves, because many who had been attacked were still finding it difficult to trust and to communicate. But sometimes, even in the gestures, I took note so that I could imbue my characters with those same gestures.
So how is Poe viewed after she's born? She's born with albinism, and in terms of how rare that is, or how often that happens, say, in Africa, I mean, are the statistics as to, I mean, how unique Poe is in that situation?
The statistic is quite staggering, and I think that the, if I'm not mistaken, the Under the Same Sun website gives the statistic of one in every 1,200 children born is born with albinism. Which is staggering when you consider that the international average is in the hundreds, is in the thousands. So, a genetic pool, whatever it is, there is a high concentration of albinism in that country.
Yeah, and so how is Poe? I guess, what's the reaction that she gets as she's growing up? I mean, her growing up in the book is, what's that, in the 50s, in the 60s, I guess?
In the 50s, and 60s.
And so what's shocking as I'm reading the book is, and then I read contemporary accounts, obviously, is that it remains prevalent today, and that violence and racism and prejudice, I mean, those are things that she encounters and that still happen today, right?
Yes. And it's probably been happening for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. But certainly, you know, growing up as a child in the Maasai tribe, you know, there is a tribe like most that relies on rites of passage to belong. She craves that, and she's excluded from naming ceremonies and everything else because she's perceived as someone to be afraid of, someone that is cursed in a way. So that fear permeates every aspect of her life. And if it isn't for the kindness of her aunt and the love of her aunt, and you know, Peter Ash once said to me in a discussion that the common element of any person with albinism who has gone on to succeed in life and be healthy and strong has always been that those people have had one person in their lives that has supported them unconditionally, loved them, protected them, and made them feel like they have a right to live and to be happy.
And that makes us realize that too many people without albinism don't have that one person, right?
That's right. And without judgment, too many with albinism who are surrounded by family members, usually this is in rural areas of Tanzania, where healers loom large and there are no schools or educational systems that could kind of inform people. What they rely on is myth and tradition. And as a result, that just breeds fear, because knowledge, or the lack thereof, just becomes something to be afraid of, because we don't understand it and we can't explain it.
Right. Where's Ezekiel from?
Ezekiel is from Mozambique.
And what was his upbringing or his childhood, say?
Well, Ezekiel has a Makonde mother, so a Mozambican mother, and his father is alleged to be a government official from Lisbon or from Portugal, and he was given up for adoption to a missionary family as a baby. So he struggles with his identity. He too doesn't belong. Feels like he lives in an in-between world of not knowing who he is. But like Poe, his father, Gilberto, has a tremendous affinity for this boy and raises him as if he is his son. And that helps him through a great deal.
Yeah, and so I hate to give away anything in the book, but Ezekiel and Poe, when do they meet?
Well, it was important for me to establish who they were and where they came from and the circumstances of their upbringing, so that when they do eventually meet in the second part of the book, we have a firm ground as to why they make the decisions that they do. In fact, we begin to understand very quickly when they meet in the second part, as young, she's 16, 17 years old, he's 19, 20, he's just a little bit older than her. But when they do meet, they instantly recognize this longing to be part of something bigger than they are. And it is the drawing factor that brings them together.
And these are such rich characters. I mean, the little bit that I've read of Children of the Moon, I've somewhat gotten to know them so well. What is it like for you to craft these people? I mean, these are obviously people that you've thought about a long time, that they've taken up space in your head.
Right.
It seems that they would be hard to shake off after you've written a book like this, are they?
Well, they are hard to shake off. In fact, my final trip to Mozambique, when I came home, I came home a very different person. The things that I saw, what I heard, changed me in some way. We take for granted the kind of lives that we live here in Canada, and it really is a testament to the human spirit that I don't see often here. So that was quite difficult. But, you know, it's funny that you asked the question, because I just received an email from someone who just finished the book and who said to me, "I don't know who I love more, Poe or Zeka."
Mm.
And she said it was very hard to let them both go. And that's not giving the ending away. It just meant that she wanted more.
Yeah.
And I think a writer always wants a reader to be left with the feeling that they want more.
And as you're talking about these characters now, the book is out now, and some people have had the chance to read it.
Right.
Do they? I mean, I'm not going to ask you who you love more, but I'm going to ask you if you still think about them or have stuff to say about them. Like, do you still have stuff that you want to write about them?
Well, it's an interesting question because, you know, I finished the book in October, and so when you finish a book, you try very hard to move on. Truth be told, I haven't been able to start anything new. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if my editor is hearing this right now or my agent, they're not going to be happy about that. But I haven't because I can still hear the ringing in my ears. And that may be a bad analogy, but it's really hard to shake off these composite characters. And when I say composite, they're kind of put together bits and pieces of all of the people I encountered and all of the stories they shared with me. So it's really hard to hear the story of their lives and just go on and start something new. I mean, I have an absolute newfound respect for journalists who go to war-torn areas and have human stories that they explore and somehow can crank out another piece the next day. I mean, I'm still trying to savor what it was that I went through, because it feels, certainly not to the same extent, but it feels like I've been through a bit of a war myself. And it had lingering effects with my family and the way I saw myself and my life here, and I had to kind of take stock of what it was that I wanted going forward.
Now, there was stuff about your own family history that you found out in the course of the research, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, and
right.
So I mean, that obviously, you just mentioned that it has had an effect on you. What about other members of your family that would probably have an effect on? Was that the same experience for them?
I wonder if it will. I wonder if it will. I will be honest with you. When I started this book, all three of my uncles who were somehow involved in the colonial wars, two of them have passed away. The third uncle was 14 years old, and one of the devastating effects of my second uncle, Clement, when he was at the age of 19, sent off, because it was mandatory military duty in Portugal at the time, mm-hmm. and he was sent off to Guinea-Bissau, a particularly horrific war. They were raging all on during the same time, Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau. And he went over there really not knowing what he was defending. And he came back a very lonely and broken man, but with that sense of desire that he was going to come home back to the Azores, to his family, only to find out when he came home an empty home. My grandparents and my youngest uncle, the age of 14, had emigrated to Canada.
Mm.
So because my grandmother was not going to lose another boy to that war. And so I could just only imagine his sense of abandonment, complete and total and utter abandonment, at the idea that he had come home and no one was there to greet him.
Yeah.
Now, in subsequent years, I've always kind of seen myself as the chronicler of family history.
Right.
I would ask the questions, and my uncles would always be polite, but if I pushed too hard, if I pressed further, they would get up and leave the room. There was a clear indication that they were not prepared to discuss this with me. And I think part of it was that in discussing the particulars of their experiences in war, that they would be forced to relive them.
Mm.
And that was very difficult for them.
And that's the interesting part as I'm reading the book and I'm thinking of these characters and their experiences, is that the effects of colonialism, the effects of war, that continues not only in their minds, despite trying not to talk about it, but in people of your generation, say.
That's right. And you know, I had the privilege of interviewing the president of the Ontario Association of Portuguese Veterans recently. And he told me that there are over 6,000 veterans who served in those wars who live in southern Ontario, for example. And his membership in that organization is incredibly small, a fraction of that, simply because so many of those men and women don't even want to enter into the discussion or dialogue of what happened to them. They don't want to be reminded of it.
And then what breaks my heart is this, as someone who's interested in history, is that when folks like this die, these stories go with them.
They go with them. And so this was one of the things that was fascinating to me, that, you know, my Uncle Clement, the one who served in Guinea-Bissau, I had the opportunity to speak to all three of my cousins, his children.
Yeah.
And I said, maybe it was just me that he wouldn't talk to about the war. And I said, did he ever say anything to you? And my cousin said the same thing as I did. If they pushed a little further, he just would get angry, very agitated, almost like the onset of some kind of PTSD symptoms that he didn't even quite recognize in himself. And then he wouldn't remember that he had reacted that way. So it's clear that these histories and these stories, now maybe there are veterans that share them, and in fact many of them did share them with me. One in particular I acknowledged in the acknowledgments of my book, but many of them are reluctant to do so. And I think the reluctance comes, and this is again an assertion on my part that is there's no basis, but you know, the fiction writer always talks about the what if. And you know, as opposed to the nonfiction writer, which delves into the what is. So what if the reason that they're not talking to me about it is not only that they were witnesses to horrific incidents and they don't want to be reminded of it, but also what if they participated in something that was ugly and something they're trying to run away from, which essentially is what Ezekiel is trying to do, one step in front of the other.
The your day job, if you will.
Yes.
You're a teacher librarian.
I'm a teacher librarian at a high school here in Toronto.
What is it like for you to work amongst books as you do? Right there, you've answered my question. But to also think that your books are there as well.
Well, my books get stolen from my library, which is always wonderful because I have to reorder them. But they seem to walk away. I've been an English teacher for many, many, many years. This is my 29th year teaching high school in the city of Toronto. Uh-huh. And I've always enjoyed it. It's been a gift for me to work with these young people. But when I became a writer relatively, you know, only 10 years ago, it changed the dynamic. And it was astounding how much it changed. And to be involved in the lives of our students and trying to get them involved in books and book culture and learning about worlds that are either similar to theirs or very different and a kind of escape from their own probably dreary or difficult lives.
Yeah.
It's something that I'm very proud of. And I have to say, if you can indulge me, that I grew up in a difficult situation. I at the age of 8 or 9, my father began to drink quite heavily, and it changed our home. It changed my life. And my safe place was the local community library. And there was a librarian there. Her name was Andrea. And, you know, I could escape into worlds that were similar to mine. And I could find solace in that, that I wasn't alone. Mm-hmm. And I could also pick another book off the shelf that showed me a world that was so different than mine. And it gave me hope and a sense that that there was an escape from this. So libraries and my role as a teacher librarian, I think are just, it's just been a gift, and I think it's one of the most important things out there.
And just to think that you could be a librarian like Andrea, or you're providing a space for someone growing up who's got a similar situation to like yours growing up. I mean, that makes the job. I mean, it's more than a job, isn't it?
It is, and that's why it's so disheartening. And I don't want to get too much into the politics here.
Sure.
But
yeah.
It's just been a brutal few months with the current Ontario government and their cuts. I mean, my library is now going to be closed half of the day as a result. This is a school of 2,000 teenagers who rely on that space for a whole lot of things, socialization, for access to information, for knowledge, for the exploration of books in different worlds, and to see that it's going to close half of the day, it just gets to me.
Yeah, as it should all of us, I think, even if we don't live in Ontario, when we read the news of what's going on there, I mean, people like us who revere books, who value books, I mean, it is heartbreaking, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. I want to go back to something in your book that I've been thinking about, Children of the Moon. After having written this, after having done all the research that you have on the ground, if you will, did you learn anything as to why people do bad things to one another? I mean, are you any closer to answering that question, say, that all of us think about all the time?
No. And that's a short answer, but no. And someone asked me, you know, how come this book is so different from your other two, where you're writing from a place that you know intimately, and all of a sudden, you know, you take us so far away to a place that, you know, that is very different and unusual and unfamiliar. And I say to them that for this book, what I wanted to do was I wanted to write about what I wanted to understand. There's a curiosity about the world and my place in it. I've asked those questions. I've done the groundwork. I've done the research. I've tried not to presume anything. I didn't get lazy in writing it. And yet I come back with the great mystery that I still don't know the answers to what makes people do the things they do.
I've only read, unfortunately, a very small part of the book, but I'm enjoying it a great deal. It's a very beautiful book, and I can't
Thank
wait to
John.
Finish it. I've just enjoyed very much speaking with you today. Congratulations on this book. Good luck with it.
Joel, thank you so much for giving me the time to talk about Children of the Moon.
The book is called Children of the Moon. It is published by Doubleday. Its author, Anthony Desai, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.